Well, it is good to be back in the pulpit. I had a great vacation, and I'm grateful to work for a church that provides ample vacation time for its clergy. Burnout is a serious problem for clergy types, and so is family dysfunction. By providing your pastoral staff with time off to recharge their spiritual batteries and to spend quality time with loved ones, you are helping to address both issues. And you're doing yourselves a big favor as well. The last thing you need for me and Talitha are a couple of tired, angst-ridden pastors who are too consumed with issues at home to be of any use to the church. So three cheers for vacation. But three cheers also for coming back from vacation. I love being your pastor. And I love it especially when I'm refreshed and have the energy I need to do the job as best I can. And while we're at it, three cheers for summer. With its rhythm of rest and work, summer is a season of creative energy. When relaxation makes us strong for the coming fall. When we look to the future with time to reflect on the past. During summer, we wear sandals without fear. And shorts without shame. And Hawaiian shirts without irony. During the summer, kids can sleep in, and grown-ups can use the warmth of the afternoon as an excuse to drink cold, bubbly wine in the lingering light of the long, slow evenings. Three cheers for summer. That being said, I must admit that this summer, the news, first from along the U.S.-Mexico border and then out of Gaza and then out of Iraq and now more recently out of Ferguson, Missouri, the news has threatened in a serious way to harsh my mellow. Images of children incarcerated by the U.S. Border Patrol. Images of children in hospitals where they're not safe from U.S.-made Israeli bombs. Images of children stuck with their families on a mountaintop waiting either for rescue or for genocide. And now images of reporters being gassed and arrested outside of St. Louis by militarized police who don't want the world to know how they treat those who have come to protest the recent death of an unarmed African-American young man who was shot with his hands in the air. All of these images have made me feel, in the middle of August, a little bit of the despair usually reserved for January. I was born late in the summer that followed the summer of love. 1 year and 2 months after the Beatles released Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. I spent my teenaged years at a time when the world seemed relatively calm. Sure, there were wars in Central America, and Nelson Mandela was still in prison, and the AIDS epidemic was just getting started, but Vietnam was in our past. And by the time I was ready to march in support of civil rights, the work of removing legal barriers to equality had, for the most part, moved off the streets and into the courthouse. By the time I graduated from high school, the United States and the Soviet Union were starting to work out their differences. And by the time I was done with seminary, the Berlin Wall was down, and the final decade of the 20th century seemed so different from the 80 years that preceded it, I thought we'd moved into a better world. And maybe we did for a time. But now I'm starting to question it. Sometimes it seems to me that what passes for good news is just news that isn't quite so awful. So you might ask, what keeps me doing what I do? Why preach when the world is losing its ability to be molded and formed by wisdom and common sense? When hope melts faster than spilt slushy on a Labor Day sidewalk? Well, the answer is this. I preach because I believe we can change. not just as individuals, but as communities and nations. We can change, and we must change. This evening's lesson from Mark is about change. Talitha mentioned this story in last week's sermon, and this morning she assured me that she hadn't looked ahead to find that this was the lectionary reading for this week. But at first reading, this is a story in which Jesus changes his mind. This, by the way, is something with which I didn't used to be very comfortable. It used to trouble me a lot. The person I was 20 years ago had a hard time with the notion that Jesus, as God incarnate, was able to be of two minds about anything. And I wasn't alone in that opinion. For centuries, readers of this story have tried to find ways to make it not say what clearly it says, which is that Jesus, after speaking with a woman in what today is southern Lebanon, decides it's really okay for him, as a Jewish man, to heal the daughter of a Syrian woman. And it's not just that Jesus made some kind of tactical adjustment in his ministry. The mother in question confronted Jesus with his ugly prejudices, and Jesus changed. He changed not just his mind, but also his heart. It is a remarkable story. But this story is not just a story about Jesus changing. Like many of the stories about Jesus that we read in the Gospels, this story about Jesus isn't really just about Jesus. It's about the church. The four Gospels that we have in the New Testament were written at a time of crisis in the early church, a time when Christianity was making a critical transition from being a Jewish sect to being a separate and distinct religion. And this move took place at a time when all of Judaism was in disarray, thanks to the Roman sack of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. In this time of institutional flux, one of the most important questions the early Christians had to face was this: would the new religious movement be open to non-Jews? Could Gentiles claim a place in the Christian household of faith? And initially, the answer was no. But as people like St. Paul preached the gospel in places farther and farther removed from the historical borders of Israel, the calls for Gentile inclusion in the Christian church got louder and louder. The author of Matthew's gospel almost certainly included this story as a way of addressing the issue of Gentile inclusion in the church. And the message seems to be this: if Jesus could change his mind, so can the church. If Jesus could confront his own prejudices, so can the church. And the church did change. It did confront its prejudices, and it chose something better. It chose to be a welcoming institution. It turns out that the divinity of Christ and the righteousness of the church are not manifested in being right all of the time. Rather, they are measured in an ability, when necessary, to change. And as I look at human history, I am comforted by the knowledge that the church isn't the only institution that has changed. Despite all of our failures, and despite all of the ongoing violence that marks human history, still there is hope that perhaps the arc of the moral universe, though long, actually does bend toward justice. As bad as things are in Israel and Gaza today, they were much worse in 1915 when the Ottoman Empire committed a genocide against the Armenians and the international community paid no attention and remained silent. At least in Gaza, the world is paying attention. And as bad as things are in Ferguson, Missouri,
We've arrived at a time when most Americans don't believe it's okay for the police to shoot an unarmed man with his arms up in a sign of surrender, even if he does look like someone who may or may not have just robbed a convenience store. For all of the personal, institutional, and systematic racism that abides in the American soul, most of us genuinely want to live in a country where everyone is treated equally under the law. It would be good if more of us, especially those of us who are white, did more to, and said more to move our nation along the road toward full integration, equal opportunity, equal justice. And the events in Ferguson remind us that we have a lot yet to do and a long way to go. But still, our nation has changed in some really positive ways. As I wrote these words at a cafe on Park Boulevard, an African-American man and a white woman, both on the cusp of middle age, were sitting on a nearby couch, flirting like a couple of teenage sweethearts. They were trying to get work done on their respective electronic devices, but they were unable to resist the feelings that until 1967 would have been illegal in several American states and would have been unacceptable, perhaps even in our own community, until much more recently than that. And I choose to believe that such flirtation is a mark of grace, a sign and a seal of the world that awaits if we but listen to the voices of those who call us to change. Such evidence of change must not make us complacent, rather, it should inspire us for the road ahead. When Jesus changed his mind, he did so as far from Jerusalem, as far from the center of religious power as the Gospel of Matthew ever places him. And he had to listen to someone whose beliefs and upbringing were radically different from his own. And when the church changed its mind around including Gentiles, it did so because Christian missionaries had traveled far from home and had met people who were unlike the people of their homeland. These encounters with the new and the different inspired a shift toward inclusion. And that can happen for us today as well. When we move beyond what is comfortable and familiar, when we meet people who are different from us, and when we recognize in them a common humanity, and if we listen with genuine respect to what they have to say, then we can change. And if we can change, then so can the politicians and the generals, the militants and the police who have been doing their level best to rob my summer of its joy by using lethal force against those they refuse to see as fully human. Perhaps a mother in some far-off place will help them to see the beauty in her child's eyes. Perhaps the Christian church will lead by the example of its own slow but steady march toward inclusion. Perhaps you, with your longing for a just and peaceful world, will make your voice heard, even in a small way, and someone, somewhere, perhaps in a far-off place, will take note and will change. I don't know how the world will change. I don't even know if the world will change. But I do know that the world can change, because you and I can change, and the church can change, and even Jesus can change. The possibility for change, even if it isn't a probability, the possibility for change still gives me hope. And now, dearly beloved, let's make that hope dance into a brighter, more peaceful, more livable future. Amen.